Will your church be one of the issues, etc. 300? Hi, this is Todd Wilkin. We're looking for 300 congregations to pledge $1,000 to Issues Etc. in their budgets. To find out more about the Issues Etc. 300, click the support page of our website, issuesetc.org. You'll even find a one-page informational flyer. Please consider including Issues Etc. in your church's mission or advertising budget. The Issues Etc. 300. Many Christians regard these events as almost so familiar as to not require any review, any further study. Well, sure, they're significant, but everyone knows what happened. Everyone knows what happened as Jesus neared the very end. He knew what was coming. He had predicted it. He had planned it. This is within his will. He wants to do this. He's going to the cross and getting there. Well, we call it the Passion of Christ, and we're going to be looking at the Passion of Christ according to the Gospel of Luke on this Good Friday. Greetings and welcome to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. Joining us for the next hour, Dr. Arthur Just. He's professor of New Testament and director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. Dr. Just, welcome back.
Wonderful to be with you on this very holy day.
How is Luke's account of the Passion of Christ different from the other gospel writers?
Well, you have to begin by asking the question, I mean, who is Luke writing to? We believe that Luke is a second-generation gospel, which means that Matthew's gospel was probably written before him, perhaps even Mark, but Matthew being first. Matthew writing a Jewish audience, Luke writing a Gentile audience. And so Luke is going to be accenting certain things that Gentiles would be particularly, you know, interested in. For one is, and I think this also would certainly apply to the Jews, but they understood that God's Messiah was going to suffer. And what the Gentiles would have really struggled with is, why is somebody who receives such a scandalous death, such a humiliating death, such an, you know, according to the Roman standards, kind of the most horrific death that you could possibly, you know, experience, why should we honor this man as God? Why should we call him Lord? I mean, what is it about Jesus' death that makes it in any way palatable to a Gentile audience? So Luke is going to shape his narrative to try to not take away the suffering or the shame or the humiliation, but put it in the context that a Roman citizen would understand. And my good colleague Peter Scare has really written his thesis on this. He should be the one who tells you about this, but really, he talks about it in terms of a noble death. And Jesus is portrayed, like you might find, you know, in the Roman world, as somebody who dies a death that really is to be perceived as a martyr's death, as a death of somebody who dies, you know, with courage, with honor, you know, and really, in a sense, with nobility. Now, the whole way Luke shapes his account of Jesus' death is to accent, and I think this is the major theme, the theme of innocence, that Jesus is the suffering, righteous Messiah who is innocent and goes to the cross as an innocent Savior. The entire Lucan passion narrative is focused in on this innocence. Some examples. Jesus is tried four times. Four times. The Sanhedrin, the Jewish trial, then Pilate. Then Pilate sends him to Herod, and then Herod sends him back to Pilate. Only Luke has the four trials. Five times in those four trials. By Pilate and Herod, ruthless Gentiles, Jesus is declared innocent. In fact, Herod and Pilate do not want to kill him. They don't think he's guilty of anything. His innocence is declared in his trials, and yet he is killed. What does the centurion say at Jesus' death? He doesn't, like in Matthew's gospel, say, truly this was the Son of God. He says, truly this man was, depends how you translate it, but if this man was righteous, or you could translate it innocent. Jesus innocent one. He who knew no sin becomes sin for us. This would have reverberated in the minds of the Jews, but especially the Gentiles. The other thing about Luke is everything for Luke clearly happens in Jesus' passion on the day of preparation for the Passover, Friday. And that includes the Lord's Supper. Luke makes it very clear that the Lord's Supper, the institutional Lord's Supper, the Last Supper we call it, what I call Jesus' Passover, on the night in which he was betrayed, that takes place after sundown on Thursday, which would be for them Good Friday already. So Luke's passion begins with a meal, and then, of course, we can talk about this after Easter, but the three-day sequence of Good Friday, Holy Saturday, and Sunday for Luke ends with a meal on Sunday at Emmaus. Begins with a meal and ends with a meal. And the meal it begins with is a new meal instituted by Jesus and then celebrated after he rose from the dead. There are other things that we could talk about too, and I hope that in the next hour we do. But one other thing is that the theme of the forgiveness of sins is very prominent at the death of Jesus. And that is a uniquely Lucan theme too. Something, again, certainly Jews would have resonated to, but that is a theme within the court system of Rome, that forgiveness is something that they needed to be introduced to. And the Gospel of Luke not only introduces that to them, but he does it in the passion of Jesus.
We don't ordinarily think about the passion account, including the Lord's Supper, as you said. Usually that's viewed as kind of a prelude to the passion proper. Why should we understand it as part of Christ's suffering for us?
Because that's the way Jesus wanted it to be understood. I mean, and he does it in Luke's gospel. For one, he has this statement in Luke 22, verse 15, where he says, "With deep desire, I desire." He uses the same word together. One is an adverb, one is a verb. "I desire with deep desire to eat this Passover with you before I suffer." And he wants them to see that their participation in this Passover and in the meal that he is instituting is in his death. Paul picked that up. "You proclaim his death until he comes." And he wanted to connect the Last Supper with his death. That's the primary thing that happens when we go to the supper, is we remember his death. We remember his resurrection too, but until he comes again in glory, it is his death. It's his body broken in death, his blood poured out for the forgiveness of sins that we receive. And that is very important for Luke to connect those two, especially for Gentiles. They need to see that the supper that they are eating in places like Corinth and Ephesus and the like is a proclamation of Jesus' death.
There's the beginning of the trial phase, if you will, is a particularly Jewish thing. And I imagine writing to Gentiles, Luke might have felt the need to kind of explain what's going on. But he begins at the high priest's house and apparently convening what's called the Council of the Sanhedrin. What kind of a trial would this have been for Jesus?
Well, the trial before the Sanhedrin is the one that clearly indicates who it is that wants him dead. And in a way, you've got to go back to his entrance into Jerusalem and the week that he spends there on the Temple Mount teaching. But, I mean, the Sanhedrin meets on the same, place where Jesus is teaching. They meet, at the end of the marketplace on the Temple Mount, and Jesus is teaching a few hundred yards from there, if that. And the Sanhedrin really, were kind of the adjudicatory board of Israel, run by the Sadducees, the chief priests who are in control of the Temple Mount, who really didn't have much concern about Jesus. But it's Passover, and Pharisees are there, and they're part of the Sanhedrin, and they want Jesus dead. And they're the ones who agitate, and they finally get the high priest to realize that Jesus is teaching about the temple and contrary to the temple on your own Temple Mount, and you ought to do something about it. And I think, they're the ones who really sort of, push the death of Jesus to its point of no return. They're the ones who make the charges against Jesus. And they're lies, you know. They're the ones who, you know, basically bring up charges against Jesus that are not true. And it's interesting the way in which it comes out that they're the ones who actually bring out all the truth about who Jesus is. They ask him, "Are you the Christ?" Okay, up until this time, we sure know he's the Christ. You know, there's one of the great titles. Jesus speaks of himself as the Son of Man, another great title. Then they say, "Are you the Son of God?" And then Jesus says, "You yourselves are saying that I am." That's the I am of the Old Testament. So in the trial before the Sanhedrin, the ones who want him dead, the ones who bring up false charges against him, there is revealed in that trial that he's the Christ, he's the Son of Man, he's the Son of God, he's the I am from the Old Testament. You know, they know who he is, but they are afraid of the people. They're afraid how he is going to sway them, as he has in his teaching on the Mount. And so they need to put him to death. And they're all the way through the rest of the trials, they're the ones who go to Pilate, "Crucify him, crucify him." They're the ones who push Pilate and Herod to the point, really Pilate, where he really doesn't feel he has a choice but to give him over to the crowds.
All right, let's take a break there. And when we come back, Dr. Justice said something very intriguing, that Jesus' enemies, the Pharisees primarily, and then along with them, the Sadducees, at the very least, they've heard who Jesus is. They know who he is, and yet he must be killed. And they will stop at nothing, literally stop at nothing, until they can bring about Jesus' death. And yet, we know that this is not the doing of man, but of God. And no one is taking Jesus' life from him. More on the Passion of Christ according to the Gospel of Luke with Dr. Arthur Just on this Good Friday after this.
Ah, the sounds of rich liturgy and historic Christian worship. What a way to spend a Sunday morning. At Trinity Lutheran Church in Millstadt, Illinois, you'll find authentic Christianity as you hear the preaching of Christ crucified for the forgiveness of your sins. Come, join us Sunday mornings at 9 and Monday evenings at 7:30, and find out more about Trinity Lutheran Church, Millstadt, Illinois, at trinitymillstadt.org.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Old theology, new technology. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Issues, Etc. relies on a small group of faithful supporters called the Issues, Etc. Reformation Club. These people have pledged to become monthly or annual contributors to Issues, Etc., and this allows us to budget our expenses more efficiently. Now, there are four levels of giving. The Confessor, $25 monthly or an annual gift of $250. The Apologist, $50 monthly or an annual gift of $500. The Reformer, $100 monthly or an annual gift of $1,000. And the Patron, $200 monthly or an annual gift of $2,000. Each Reformation Club member receives premiums like books, transcripts, and the I Have Issues t-shirt. You can join the Issues Etc. Reformation Club by contacting Craig. His email address, craig@issuesetc.org. Or you can call 618-223-8385. 618-223-8385. The Issues Etc. Reformation Club. Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. It's Good Friday. Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. We're studying the Passion of Christ according to the Gospel of Luke. Dr. Just is author of the Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. Before the break, Dr. Just, you said something that was intriguing, and I wonder if I might have misunderstood you, but I find, if I didn't, this very interesting. You say that the enemies of Jesus here in the first trial, they have heard who he is. They're asking all the right questions. Do they, in fact, know that Jesus is the Christ?
Well, you know, that's a kind of a tough question to answer with any kind of passage from Luke that says, yeah, they do. I got to read between the lines there. But, I mean, here's what I always say. These are the biblical scholars. These are the ones who have been trained. Paul, for example, who probably was part of this crowd because he's in Jerusalem with, you know, in the school of Gamaliel. He knows his Bible. He knows the messianic prophecies. He knows how Jesus has lined up against the Old Testament prophecies. It's hard for me to believe that they don't know who he is. Now, they ask the right questions. The first charge is, when the Sanhedrin gets together, is, you know, if you are the Christ, tell us. I mean, they're asking, are you the Messiah? I think they know. And then the second, are you the Son of God? And Jesus, you know, in both cases, he doesn't really answer the question, but he does. I mean, he says in his response to the first one, are you the Christ? If I tell you, you will surely not believe. And if I ask, you will surely not answer. But from now on, the Son of Man will be sitting at the right hand of the power of God. You know, I think they understand. It's sort of like a little bit like the apostles. They understand, but they don't fully get it. You know, in the case of the Sanhedrin, they're kind of against Jesus. The apostles are for him. But nobody really understands until after he rises from the dead. Now, I think that their charges when they come before Pilate are really mean-spirited. I mean, they bring him and they accuse him, saying, this man we found perverting our nation. Okay, how did he do that? What's the evidence there? It's pretty hard to find any. And then preventing the giving of tribute of taxes to Caesar. That's just completely not true. He said, render unto Caesar what is Caesar's. So they're lying there. And then saying that he himself is Christ, a king. Well, he never really said that, or at least not in the gospel up to this point. The first time Jesus calls himself Christ is in the Emmaus story. And, you know, is he claiming to be king? Well, I mean, that's what the Messiah is, but he certainly isn't a military king. He's not a political king. And Pilate, who went into the temple, this is in Luke 13, during Passover, and while they are bringing the blood of the lambs up into the holy place, okay, Pilate kills the Galilean and mixes their blood there on the Temple Mount because he feels those Galileans were a threat. In other words, Pilate's a ruthless man. He'll do whatever it takes to keep people from taking over, you know, and being king, so to speak. He doesn't think Jesus is a threat. He wants to wash his hands of it. He thinks, I mean, what does he say? I find no charge against this man. I find no legal cause, is essentially what he says. You know, and the final charge against Jesus by the Jews is he incites the people, teaching throughout all Judea and having begun from Galilee unto here. Now, there's the first honest thing they say, and that is exactly right. Not that he incites the people in a bad way. He incites them in a good way. They want him because he's a healer. He brings forgiveness. He brings wholeness to bodies. He heals body and soul, and he incites them into love and mercy is what he does. And he has been teaching this throughout all Judea, and they don't like it, and they want it to stop. And he's there on the Temple Mount now, you know, and his, you know, he does speak against the temple. I mean, as he comes into Jerusalem, he weeps over it. He says, not one stone is going to be left here. I mean, that's not something I'm sure that the chief priests want to hear. This is their place of where they do their thing, their liturgical and sacrificial rites. But, I mean, Pilate and Herod, two ruthless men, they can't find anything wrong with Jesus. They can't. And so, I mean, who really wants him dead? His religious opponents, the ones who in many ways he is closest to, the Pharisees, but who's also so far apart because the Pharisees are the way of the law and Jesus is the way of the gospel, and they don't see that this is exactly what the Old Testament is talking about. And maybe they do see it and they just don't want it to happen because they've got a good thing going. I mean, they're rich men, and they're rich because they administer the religious life of Israel to their advantage. I mean, it's really hard to put your finger on it, but boy, there's no reason why they shouldn't know that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of God, the very things they're asking him.
Moving to the crucifixion proper and to what Christ says in those hours of anguish and suffering, one thing that I think is unique, if I'm not mistaken, to Luke's gospel at the beginning of his crucifixion account, something that Jesus says to women, this is before he is crucified, but he's on his way to the crucifixion. There are women who are mourning along the way, and he says to them there in verse 28 of chapter 23, I believe, daughters of Jerusalem, do not weep for me, but weep for yourselves and for your children.
Yeah.
What is he saying?
Well, you know, there are four warnings here that Jesus is giving. And they're all ones that you know, are for the women, for everyone. But, I mean, they're directed to the daughters of Jerusalem, which is not too far from daughters of Zion, which means Israel. That's in the Old Testament. This is a reference to Israel. And he's saying, you know, weep for those children of yours who do not recognize that I'm the Messiah, because the days are coming, you know, when blessed are the barren, you know, blessed are the wombs that did not give birth, you know, that there is going to be a final reckoning. They will begin to say, fall on us and the hills cover us. And now, I think there's a twofold reference here. There's the destruction of the temple in Jerusalem, which he talked about as he came into Jerusalem. He talked about it in Luke 21 during his discourses on the end times, one on Jerusalem and one on the end of the world, both of which are really, in a sense, the same thing, one a foretaste of the other. And then that very, very enigmatic statement in verse 31, for if to the moist wood they do these things, to the dry, what will happen? You know, and I mean, there's various ways of interpreting that, you know, but I mean, basically the same meaning is in play there, and that is that the moist wood refers to Jesus and the dry wood refers to those who reject Jesus. And if people treat me this way, if they admit that I'm innocent, how will they treat those who are really guilty? And that applies, you know, if it's the Romans treat me this way or the Jews deal with me this way, if God permits this to happen to someone who's innocent, what's going to happen to the guilty? What it shows is that this is an end time moment. This is what the whole history of the cosmos has been pointing to. That God's justice is going to come down to this man who is going to be punished by God for us, that we're not going to be punished because of our sins. Jesus is going to stand there in our place, that God's justice against sin is going to be leveled out against this innocent man. That's the whole point of the innocence, that this suffering righteous one is going to do what no one else can do, because he is the very Son of God, and that he is the one who is going to be there for the daughters of Zion, and they should not weep over him because he's doing it on their behalf. They should weep over those who do not see him as the suffering righteous one, the innocent one, the one who is truly, truly the innocent one, as the centurion says, standing in their place for their sin.
With about a minute and a half before our break, the first words that Christ utters from the cross itself, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they do. What's in there? About a minute and a half.
Well, these words have to be balanced with really, I mean, not the very last words, but the last words that he says before the darkness comes. And that is, today you will be with me in paradise. Both of those are absolutions. One is for the whole world, the people of the world, you know, all his enemies, those who are crucifying, those whose sins he bears. And then he finally has a specific absolution for a thief who is converted there by watching this suffering, innocent, righteous one be tortured and inflicted with the punishment of the soldiers and the mocking of the rulers and the people on the cross. He's converted by how Jesus there speaks to them and how he, in a sense, endures it. And when he says, today you will be with me in paradise, that's an absolution for this individual man. So you've got kind of this universal absolution and this individual absolution.
Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. We're talking about the Passion of Christ according to the Gospel of Luke on this Good Friday. When we come back, we'll move through some other words spoken by Christ from the cross. Dr. Arthur Just is professor of New Testament and director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. You can find a link to Heaven on Earth at our website, issuesetc.org, under the Listen on Demand page, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House and ask them about Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. Their toll-free number, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Thanks to the following congregations for standing with us by joining the Issues Etc. 300. Christ Lutheran, Jackson, Mississippi. Prince of Peace Lutheran, San Diego, California. Trinity Lutheran, Tryon, North Carolina. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Dallas, Texas. Calvary Lutheran, Yuma, Arizona. St. Paul Lutheran, Milford Center, Ohio. Peace Lutheran, Chehalis, Washington. Christ Lutheran, Noblesville, Indiana. Our Redeemer Lutheran, Lexington, Kentucky. And St. James Lutheran, Baltimore, Maryland. Find out how your church can support this worldwide outreach by including Issues Etc. in your mission or advertising budget. Just go to our website, issuesetc.org, click support, and print the one-page flyer. When your congregation joins the Issues Etc. 300, we'll publicize your congregation on the radio, at our website, and in the Issues Etc. journal. issuesetc.org, click support, the Issues Etc. 300.
Listen to what you want, when you want. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Why does embryonic research get all the money?
This is a special commentary from the Susan B. Anthony List, named for the suffragette who was proudly pro-life.
The number of success stories resulting from adult stem cell research is on the rise, while embryonic stem cell research has yet to cure anyone. So why is it, you might ask, that embryonic research, which requires the killing of human embryos to harvest their stem cells, receives millions of dollars in government grants? It's a good question with an unfortunate answer. According to one expert, it's partly because many drug companies lobby Congress. Such companies make no money from adult stem cells because they're taken from the actual patient, but they hope to make a profit from medicines that may one day come from human embryos.
This is Marjorie Dannenfelser, president of the Susan B. Anthony List. To join us in our battle for life, visit our website at sba-list.org.
Welcome back. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. On this Good Friday, we're looking at the Passion of Christ according to the Gospel of Luke with Dr. Arthur Just. Dr. Just, I don't know if you said anything about this, but again, there's another proclamation of Christ's innocence, just backing up a verse or two from where we were before the break, from the one thief on the cross. This man has done nothing wrong. Especially contrasted with their, he says, we're getting the due reward for our deeds.
Yeah, no, that's right. There's another, I mean, there's so many of them. I think somebody counted, and I always forget the number, I think there's seven in all in the Passion account, starting with the trials. And, of course, the climactic one being the centurion. You know what else is interesting about the crucifixion scene? It begins, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they do. And then, today you will be with me in paradise. And between those two, you basically have the soldiers and the people respond in a very kind of uncaring way, and then a fourfold mocking of Jesus. And then in the mocking, you know, you get the titles again. Save others, let him save himself. If this one is the Christ of God, the chosen one, and then the soldiers mock him, and they say, if you are the king of the Jews, save yourselves. And then the inscription, the King of the Jews, you know. And then finally, one of the suspended evildoers blasphemes him and say, are you not the Christ? I mean, twice he's referred to as the Christ. Twice he's referred to as the King of the Jews. I mean, it's amazing how you can learn about who Jesus is just by, you know, tuning into the trials and the mocking that takes place on the cross itself. But you know, we all kind of love, in a sense, that conversion on the cross. And in many ways, the thief on the cross is the first catechumen, you know, who, in a sense, enters into paradise. His baptism is his death, like Jesus. You know, Luke pictures Jesus' death as a baptism in blood. This thief on the cross, in a sense, is baptized in his own blood. And later on, Hippolytus, one of the early church fathers, when asked the question, what happens to a catechumen if he dies before baptism, he says, well, we'll just consider him baptized in his own blood. Well, here you have that very thing. And, you know, you can see the statement of faith by this penitent, you know, thief on the cross, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. And Jesus tells us then, today you will be with me in paradise, which means today I enter my kingdom. Today you enter with me, because it is here on this cross, and this is the greatest irony. And again, this would have impressed the Gentile that his kingdom, his coronation as king, which is what they're calling him, is here in suffering with a crown of thorns and with this kind of shameful, humiliating death. This is what his kingdom is about. It's a kingdom of suffering. It's a kingdom where you see kind of the glory of God in the suffering and death of his son.
There are 3 hours of darkness, and I'm struck at how briefly Luke goes through this account, especially compared to Matthew's account of it. 3 hours of darkness, the sun's light failed, says Luke. The curtain of the temple is torn in two, and then Jesus dies with the words, Father, into your hands, I now commit my spirit. What is he doing there?
Well, I think that these are what I call the apocalyptic signs. And what I mean by that is these are the signs that reveal, and that's what apocalyptic means, reveals that this is where God is accomplishing what the whole gospel is about, what the plan of salvation announced at Jesus' baptism was about. You know, when the heavens open and the Spirit comes down and the voice of the Father says, this is my beloved Son. Here, the heavens now are darkened. And this is, it could not happen on this day. It's not an eclipse. This is the total plunge of darkness. And, I mean, you wonder why people didn't, you know, I mean, it must have been frightening. And there's, in a sense, no comment about it. But imagine that. Complete darkness. That's the sign in the heaven. Luke keeps it simple. Sign in the heaven is the darkness. Sign on earth is the tearing of the temple curtain. Both of them are signs now that it is now coming to a close. The work of redemption, that everything that Jesus needed to do is being accomplished. And these are signs that reveal this. That's why they're apocalyptic. In kind of the earth and in the heavens. And when he says, Father, into your hands I entrust my spirit, that's the equivalent of John's gospel, it is finished. I am done. I am handing over my spirit. And after having said this, he breathes out. I mean, he dies. He breathes out his last. You're right, Todd. You observe correctly. It's very simple. And that's the way Luke does it. Luke always takes the great moments like the incarnation, the crucifixion, the death of Jesus, the resurrection, and he understates them. They are not, I mean, most of the fanfare is in other places, but that the very great moments in sort of an elegant way, Luke just simply states it very, very, you know, simple is the best word, simple. No flowery language, it just happens. And this is really where, you know, the finality of God's work of redemption is described. Now, in a sense, the real kind of fanfare is what happens when it happens. The centurion, seeing what happens, glorifies God, saying, in reality, I mean, that's what those words mean, in reality, this man was innocent, righteous. And he declares what everybody who's reading this, you know, and knows the story and sees it unfold, what everybody recognizes is the truth. Jesus, the one who knew no sin, dies because he takes upon himself our sin. Now, here's another great theme, and I think it's an important one. Jesus, because he does not die for his own sin, is a person who is sinned against, the most sinned against person ever in the history of the world. And being sinned against oftentimes creates shame. It's when you're, you know, you haven't done anything, but somebody does something to you. And that's oftentimes, you know, like with abuse, especially sexual abuse and the like. Jesus there in nakedness, in shame, sinned against, honors the whole cosmos in a noble death. And what he declares to the entire world in his death is that I am taking your shame for you so that I might honor you, you know, in this humiliation, in this shame, because of what I'm doing on your behalf. I mean, whoa, the Gentiles would have looked at that and say, my goodness, that is a noble death. That is the death of a martyr. That is the death of somebody who goes into battle with courage and dies, you know, the kind of death that a gladiator or a Roman general would die, facing it with courage and with nobility.
In verse 48 and 49, but in particular 48, something, again, unrecorded by the other gospel writers, but by Luke, the people who have been out just either casually or because they're among the crowds that are mocking him, who come out for the spectacle, go away ashamed of themselves, apparently. It says, beating their breasts.
Yeah. I think you said it. They are ashamed of themselves, and I think they recognize at that point that they have participated in something that was, from a human point of view, they crucified a man who was not guilty of sin. But I mean, from a point of view of God, he was guilty of sin, but not his own sin, our sin. And what is unique there is how the women are there. They're standing at a distance, but they're there, the ones who followed him from Galilee and who were seeing these things. They will be critical in Luke 24 when Jesus rises from the dead. They're the ones who are in many ways the major players, at least at the first part of the gospel there, the first part of the story in Luke 24 of the resurrection of Jesus. But you're right. I mean, the crowds there begin their repentance, so to speak, collective repentance, and beating of the breasts is a sign of contrition and a sign of great sorrow.
With only a minute here, just kind of a question, a kind of a logistical question. Luke obviously is most likely not an eyewitness to these things. So how would he have come by the information about these particular events at the cross? Only a minute before our break.
Well, he says in his prologue that he discussed this with eyewitnesses who became ministers of the word. So he did his research, and he was with Paul in Jerusalem when Paul went there for, you know, his final, you know, part of the third missionary journey. And so he consulted with people who were there, and I mean, he knew some of the apostles. He probably discussed this with John in Ephesus. I mean, he had great sources. There was also some traditions, and some of them were called the Jerusalem traditions. They tended to be family traditions like Emmaus, the infancy narratives. And I think some of the earliest traditions about the death of Jesus were kept in Jerusalem. And so his going to Jerusalem with Paul is probably where he got an opportunity to really hear firsthand from those who were there what happened.
When we come back at the burial, it's hasty. It is done as the sun is literally going down, so that everyone may rest on the Sabbath. In fact, verse 56 says, they returned, they prepared spices and ointments on the Sabbath. They rested according to the commandment. Is Christ's burial and the day that follows his Sabbath rest? We'll answer that question on the other side of the break as we talk about the Passion of Christ according to the Gospel of Luke with Dr. Arthur Just. Are you looking for a Christ-centered, cross-focused church? Check out the Find a Church page at our website, issuesetc.org. Are you tired of worship that's more about self-help than the Savior, the Christian rather than the Christ, and Christ in you instead of Christ for you? It's not about you. It's about Jesus for you. Find a church near you, issuesetc.org, and click Find a Church.
Did you know that you can listen to Issues Etc. 24/7? Check out our website, issuesetc.org, and go to the Listen On Demand page. Listen at the gym, in your kitchen, in your garden, on your iPod, your computer, or in your car. The technology may be new, but the truth never changes. Issues Etc. On Demand audio, available for your convenience at issuesetc.org. 10 hours of new programming each week. issuesetc.org, and click Listen On Demand.
The cross is always relevant. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Check out the new Issues Etc. YouTube video, A Cloud of Witnesses.
What went for Mary, the angel speaks in her ear and changes who she is precisely what happens to every Christian. The Lord speaks and He changes you.
James is a great example to us of sober-minded churchmanship.
The cross looms over all of John's ministry. It's about the cross, the Lamb of God.
We see in Nicholas his love of Jesus Christ acting out in mercy for his neighbors, and we see a role model there that we can imitate.
The church, when she sets the day aside to remember St. Elizabeth, is remembering this shining light of a benevolent charity and humility.
It's not a popular position, you know, to stand for true doctrine, and yet that's what Ambrose does.
You can watch A Cloud of Witnesses, our new YouTube video, under the support page at issuesetc.org. Historic, authentic Christian radio. Issues, etc.
Welcome back. 10 more minutes on the Passion of Christ according to the Gospel of Luke on this Good Friday. Dr. Arthur Just is our guest. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Just, the burial is hasty. It is complete, but it is done in preparation for what must take place the next day, which is everyone resting on the Sabbath. Is Christ's burial and the day that he spends there in the tomb, is this a Sabbath rest for him in some sense?
I think that's exactly what it is. And I think what it shows us is that in order, you know, for us to see the kind of the movement from the day of preparation, Sabbath, Good Friday, Jesus, and this is how I always talk about it, he has to take his Sabbath rest in the tomb to, in a sense, bring to fulfillment what the Sabbath really is. And I think that you're right. The scene is hasty. But again, it's kind of uniquely Lucan in the way in which he talks about Joseph, a member of the Sanhedrin, a good and righteous man. You know, those are exactly the same words that he used of Simeon in the temple in Jerusalem. So you have how he begins with Simeon, and now he ends with Joseph of Arimathea. And you know what it's about? It's about the body of Jesus. And that's, you know, one other way of looking at Luke's, you know, passion. Follow the body of Jesus. What happens to this body? And you can even go back kind of before, you know, they anoint the body beforehand for burial, the women do. You know, the day of preparation, which is Friday, that's when they make, you know, the preparations for the Passover. What are they preparing? They're preparing a meal in which he's going to give his body. You know, now at the very end of this day of preparation, this day before the Sabbath, in which Jesus does rest in the tomb, they are preparing his body for burial. They take it down from the cross and wrap this body in linen cloths. Now, that's a huge Lucan theme. the body of Jesus wrapped in linen cloth. What's a sign of the incarnation? What is a sign to the shepherds? Ye shall find the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes, lying in a manger. That is the sign that the Messiah is born. What is the sign that the Messiah has died? They take his body down from the cross, wrap it in linen bands, and place it in a tomb in which no one has ever lied before. I mean, then what is the sign of the resurrection? The sign of the resurrection is Peter rising up, running to the tomb. And what does he stoop down and look into the tomb and see? He sees the linen cloths alone that bore the body of the crucified one, the body of the babe wrapped in swaddling clothes. So you have linen cloths in Luke's gospel as a sign of incarnation, a sign of atonement, and a sign of the resurrection. I mean, these are all part of kind of Luke's literary genius, but the way in which he shows the connection between all these events.
It's hard to read it without, I mean, and he does a great job of not tipping his hand, except maybe at one point in verse 55 where he says the women who had come with him, that is Joseph, for Jesus from Galilee, followed and saw the tomb and how his body was laid, a kind of a detail that wouldn't be necessary unless he anticipates 2 days later the women returning to that tomb and finding no body there.
And exactly. And they come, of course, and it's great the way this is in a sense for after the Easter talking about the resurrection, but it's great how he moves from the Sabbath, how they kept it and they rested according to the commandment, the law. I mean, they're looking at it from the old day. And then on the first day, in the deep dawn, I mean, that's the deep, deep dawn where you don't know that it's really light or dark yet, the coming of the light. They come to the tomb thinking that they're going to anoint a dead body. And that's why they observed how it had been laid, so they would know what to do when they got there, But it's, the movement from the old to the new. But Jesus, in a sense, takes the Sabbath and really, in a way, changes it now by his rest in the tomb. Because, I mean, the new day of worship is not going to be the Sabbath. It's going to be that first day of the week, the day of the resurrection. And you have this really profound, especially for a Jew, this profound shift from the old reckoning of time to the new reckoning of time. And that took a while for them to sort that out. But once they did, I mean, the first day of the week, that's the big day because it's the day of light. It's the day in which his body now has risen from the dead.
The review of this account that Luke has given us of Christ's passion is striking, not only for the way he, as you said, kind of elegantly brings these things all together, those things that he chooses to highlight, but also in what must have been, at least visually for those who witnessed it, their most traumatic thing they'd ever seen. He does not dwell upon the gore, the agony. One might even get an impression that it's a kind of a cross without a ton of suffering, which it certainly wasn't. Why does he simply tell us these facts in this cursory way?
Well, I think, and that's the one passage, it's not the only one, there are a number of we haven't talked about in the Passion, there's so many other things to say, but the Garden of Gethsemane, there he actually uses the word agonia. And my good colleague Peter Scare talks about how there are two different ways of talking about that. There's kind of just the agony of pure pain and suffering, or there's the agony, and here's the noble death of the athlete who's striving, the one who is, doing a noble thing. And, he sweats drops of blood there. I think what Luke is suggesting, and it really I think comes across as you read it carefully, that the height of Jesus' suffering is in Gethsemane. The height of his suffering is the spiritual suffering, the emotional suffering, the suffering that comes from facing the darkness of what he must encounter. And in his prayer to his Father, where he does sweat drops of blood, where he is assisted by the angels, so to speak, in that incredible moment of suffering. And when he comes out of that in Luke, he comes out of it as the serene Savior, ready to take on whatever it is that must be taken on. And you know, the physical suffering is certainly brutal and awful, but having faced the darkness, you know, and in a sense, the spiritual struggle that he does in his body, it's a bodily and spiritual struggle. So I don't want to in any way underestimate the physical part of the Gethsemane struggle. But that is in a sense, the agonia, you know, of the noble death that really is the height of his suffering.
Then with about 30 seconds, we've reviewed the Passion of Christ according to Luke's Gospel on this Good Friday. Why should we regard this Friday, the observance of this day, as good? Why do we call it Good Friday?
You know, it's where everything that needed to be done in order to bring about the recreation and restoration of the world to what God intended it to be, where God puts things to right, as N.T. Wright says it, or as I like to say it, where he makes right what has gone wrong. Everything that God intended to fulfill all righteousness happens there on the cross, and it is finished. It is complete. God does everything. I think the most wonderful statement about Good Friday was written by T.S. Eliot in the Four Quartets, and let me just close with his words. He writes, "The dripping blood, our only drink, the bloody flesh, our only food, in spite of which we like to think that we are sound, substantial flesh and blood. Again, in spite of that, we call this Friday good."
Folks, if you've enjoyed listening to Issues Etc. during this Holy Week, please consider making a tax-deductible gift to support this worldwide outreach. You can make a secure online donation at issuesetc.org, or you can donate by check. Make your check payable to Lutheran Public Radio and send it to LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. The address again, LPR, Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. And thanks for your support. Dr. Arthur Justice, Professor of New Testament and Director of Deaconess Studies at Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. He's author of the Concordia Commentary on Luke and the book Heaven on Earth, The Gifts of Christ in the Divine Service. Dr. Just, thank you.
A blessed end of Holy Week and 3 days as we journey with Jesus to the cross and to the empty tomb.
It's remarkable, isn't it, that all of human history could pivot around those 6 or so hours, that time of suffering, that day, Good Friday, that all of human history, all of creation, the entire universe, could turn around that one time and place. But it does. There, God Himself, as Dr. Jess so rightly said, God Himself sets right everything that we had made wrong by our sin. There God Himself atones for our sin. There God Himself suffers in our place, takes our place in death. There Christ saves the whole world. I'm Todd Wilkin. A blessed Good Friday and forward to Easter. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Lutheran Public Radio, P.O. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 912, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.